The 1995 Sam Stamp Symposium presents Session Number 252, Truth and Light in Architecture. Where does that leave the LDS Standard Plan? With discussants Ron Mullen and David Brems.
First session this afternoon, the topic is Truth and Light in Architecture. Where does that leave the LDS Standard Plan? Is that better? Oh, okay. At any rate, this is the session on Truth and Light in Architecture. Where does that leave the LDS Standard Plan? This session was kind of my idea, and I heard David Brems present a series of slides on a new Catholic church here in Salt Lake City, where light is one of the main determinants in the design. And I thought it was such an exciting building, and I thought it was such an exciting process, an adventure for the congregation to participate, to the did in creating this masterpiece that their families will enjoy and their grandchildren will use. At any rate, it's a vastly different process than the way the LDS Church builds chapels. And I just thought it'd be nice to share that with everyone. David is was born and brought up in Lehi, Utah. He's a graduate of the University of Utah Architectural School. And he is a partner in the firm of Gillis, Stransky, Brems and Smith. So with that introduction, I'm going to let David take over, and then I'm going to show you some slides on architectural history and light.
Can you hear me okay? I got a couple of handouts on this church from various publications that it's been in, which I've got 20 or so copies of a couple of different things. You're welcome to have those when we're finished. Ron, if you'll put up the first slide, we'll kind of cruise through these. I've got about 25 slides here, and probably the last 15 of them are about St. Thomas More. Little bit of background about myself. As Ron mentioned, I'm an architect practicing in Salt Lake. I've had an interest in the use of the sun in various ways in architecture and other forms ever since I was a Boy Scout, and I was working on a merit badge to get my Eagle Scout when I was a kid, and I built a solar oven and cooked my family dinner in it. When I started into architecture school in 1972, one of the things that I pursued as I went through my architecture training was the use of the sun in architecture in both the active solar ways and passive solar ways. And as time went along and I began my practice of architecture, I started to become interested in the use of sunlight as a primary source of light in buildings. You can go ahead and go to the next one if you want. I've put the first one up there. I'm not a radical environmentalist, but I do appreciate the natural forces that act upon our buildings. And I teach a class at the University of Utah as an adjunct professor in daylighting, and I also am a sailor, and I've always felt like sailing was a good metaphor for building in the environment, that with the use of sunlight, which is converted into wind, that you could go anywhere and do anything and that you wanted to do, and that there's a natural evolution that's been occurring in sailboats, at least, over thousands of years. And they continue to change and respond to the natural forces that act upon them, and they're among the most beautiful things in the world. And they don't require any additional fuel other than your ingenuity in order to make them go. Next. use of sun in architecture, religious architecture, dates back further than we really know. Stonehenge was probably a primitive form of sundial and a way to analyze the stars and try and understand something about the seasons. We really don't know very much about that. This is a sundial in India in 1724. Very sophisticated, as an instrument which was used to predict the seasons, predict the changes, predict the alignment of stars. It seems that more is known about the use of the sun in ancient times than it is in current times. And a lot of the fault of this really rests with the profession of architecture itself. Up until the early 50s, before we had cheap power and abundant lighting in the form of fluorescent lighting, all architecture was designed office buildings, houses, religious architecture to admit natural light. The evolution of religious architecture, the development of the great cathedrals, the creation of soaring spaces was really a race and a test to outdo the last one in letting in greater amounts of natural light and creating inspirational spaces. Something that's largely been lost. There's two generations of architects now practicing since the 50s that really don't know how to use natural light in buildings. Our high-technology materials like reflective glass and tinted glass has allowed us to forget about how to use natural light in buildings. Next. I threw in a couple of spaces by other architects, spaces that are really inspiring to me in the way that natural light is allowed to enter the space in a very controlled way. It's the reflective qualities, the ambiance that is created by the use of natural light, the changing nature of light, the seasonal nature of light has always impressed me greatly. Next. All different kinds of spaces, different ways to bring light into a space. I can't see any reason in any type of building that natural light should be excluded. It just needs to be properly understood so that it doesn't make people uncomfortable or create a heating and ventilating condition that is difficult to overcome. Next. This is a Jewish synagogue that I particularly like. In the total analysis of this, there's a great amount of natural light that comes in, but it's very carefully controlled and it's never allowed to fall on the congregation. Next. Another space that just has a single ray of light that comes through at a particular time of the day and also offers a little bit of view to the outside. There's a great deal of biological and psychological information that we expect from natural light. We have information about time of day, weather, season, things that human beings and other animals expect, and it's being a part of the environment, it greatly enhances our enjoyment of interior spaces when we can allow these things to come in. Next. Starting into the development of St. Thomas More. The congregation of St. Well, let me tell you how we started on that. My partner, Mike Stransky, is a devout Catholic, and he has been involved in a number of Catholic church projects, and we had an opportunity to be interviewed to do the St. Thomas More Catholic Church, and he asked me if I would participate in the design of the church, which I gladly accepted. We met with their congregation, and their congregation asked for us to provide a view of the Wasatch Mountains, and in particular the Cirque. This is located on about 80th South and 30th East. And they had seen some other churches where natural light was used or a view was incorporated and expected that we would put up some tall windows with reflective glass or tinted glass in order to control the light coming into the church. Fortunately for them, or unfortunately, I've been teaching my daylighting class at the university for 3 years and had an idea that we should bring natural light into the church and raise the interior light level to the point where there wasn't a lot of contrast from the inside to the outside and allow a view with clear glass. And that presented a lot of acoustical problems and other problems which we were able to overcome. Next. Previous shot was some light shelves that were being installed during the construction of the church, but a light shelf is a device that we use that works particularly well in Utah to shade the lower glass with the angle of the sun and reflect light into the space. So, in fact, it becomes a light fixture, the same as turning on a light. And it's wonderful in that as the sun changes and the season changes, the quality of light in the space changes, and our eye is able to adapt to a wide variety of lighting conditions. Y'all know that when you walk into a movie theater and we have what we'd say is a half of a foot candle of light, which would be the amount of light measured 1 foot away from one candle, and half of that amount, how your eye can adapt and you can move around in that space. The altitude that we live at, it's not uncommon to walk outside on a bright day like today and measure the light levels at 12 or 13, 14,000 foot candles, a huge amount of difference which our eye can change and adapt to. People who work in environments where there's natural light incorporated and there's a changing variable nature to that natural light are known to be more alert and to be more productive. We really have a biological and a psychological need for natural light. I think it's unhealthy to be inside of spaces that don't allow natural light. And with our intelligence, we can control that light. Next. So we build a model, and the way we test these things, we actually build scale models in our office, and we put a light meter inside, and we measure the amount of light to make sure that there's the right amount, and we also can put a sundial on them and take them outside, and we twist them around through all the seasons of the year and all the hours of the day and make sure that the light that's coming into the space is not uncomfortable. Next. During construction, you can see how the light shelves, now they're on the south side of the building, are becoming incorporated into the church and the amount of light that's being reflected inside. Next. The completed building, looking at it from the north side, there's no light shelves on the north side. There's no need to control the light. It's all indirect light that's being reflected into the space, and it balances the light on the south side of the church. Next. Again, same situation, looking at the north side of the church. You can see through. You can see the clear glass inside. Kind of interesting. Acoustically, the pitched roof on this building allows for the spoken word and music to be accomplished without sound reinforcement. It actually sounds better in there. We also looked at controlling the flutter, which is a sound problem, from two parallel walls side to side. And we, with this large quantity of glass, we were able to tilt the glass in the panes about 3 degrees, which diffused that flutter back and forth and made the space really wonderful acoustically inside, as well as having high-quality natural light. Next. A view of the completed light shelves. They are made out of precast concrete. We used white cement. We hope that this building will sit there very quietly and be relatively maintenance-free for at least 100 years. Next. Just some other details on the back of the building and some of the recesses and reveals. Next. View of the entry to the building. Next. Next. View inside the foyer of the building. And there's off to the left-hand corner, there's a small baptismal font that was designed by Neil Hadlock. I want to talk about, just as a sidelight, the involvement of local artists in the development of this building. Next. View of the north windows and the choir area. We also used indirect light as the source of light for nighttime use. You can see those lights turned on up above. They create a quality of the space that you also sense in the daytime at night. Next. That's a view of the altar. The altar was also designed by the sanctuary. The altar was designed by Neil Hadlock. The lectern was designed by Tom Tessman, as well as the screen behind. Next. View on a bright winter day, looking out through the light shelves. And we allowed a little bit of light to spill in. We played with that so that there's some delight in the space, as well as quality ambient light. Next. View looking straight on toward the sanctuary. The back panel of glass was designed by local artist Anna Campbell Bliss and Willie Littig, and that stained glass has about an inch and a quarter thick, and it was cast up in Logan. Next. This is the last shot showing the quality of the light in the space. We entered it in a national AIA awards competition, and we were fortunate enough to win top award for religious architecture last year with this building. That's also part of the baptismal font in this Catholic church. There's holy water always in that basin, I guess you'd call that a basin, and Catholics will go in, and some people like to touch the holy water. It's also used in their baptisms. There's either the baptismal font that you can get into, or I'm not all that well versed in the liturgy and exactly what you can and can't do with baptismal water, but it works very well for them. Well, it's actually made out of granite. And the floor is made out of slate, but it's integrated very well into the floor. Yes. The cirque is a feature in the Wasatch Mountains. It's prominent from this location, and as well as Lone Peak. There are just two really magnificent views to the south. They would like to have had a view to the east, and a view to the east with low sun angles coming up during their worship service would not have been successful. And as we kept exploring the idea of this church with the group that we worked with, we finally decided that using that intense morning light through the stained glass was a better use of that particular light. That's correct. We look at lighting problems in spaces as needing three components to be successful. We need ambient light to walk around and see what we're doing. We like to highlight certain items with spotlights. There are a few built into the ceiling that in the evening will shine on various aspects, the lectern, the altar, or down on the choir. And we also like to put some light in the space, just some decorative light, which we put the pendant light fixtures in. As you can see, they don't contribute a lot of light to the space, but they add a nice quality and a finished look to the space. Interesting to work on a church like this. I think Ron's going to talk about how Mormon churches are designed and worked with the church architect's office. In the Catholic Church, an individual parish will fundraise and they'll put together enough money to build a church, and they appoint a committee that hires an architect. They interview architects and they hire an architect, and they worked with the architect all the way through the completion of the church. It's probably one of the most difficult commissions that you ever have, because you have a group of people who are not they're not real sophisticated in procuring architectural services, for one thing, and also in the process that we go through different design phases and costing and estimating and getting bids and trying to build a church that meets their budget. This church cost $1.1 million 2 years ago. And I know when we first bid this church, we came in at about we actually had 1.3 to spend. We came in at about 1.5, and we kept hiding away a couple of $100,000 to make sure that we would get artwork in the church. And we kind of had that hidden in the chairs and the pews. And when we finally got the price in budget, then we revealed that we still had all of the artwork in the church, and it was particularly effective, as you can see, to have local artists involved. Was there a question back here? Ron might know that better than I do. I just know the cost of this building. This building is on a site that has next to it a multi-purpose center, which this parish built 15 years ago. And that has classrooms for their religious instruction. It has a gymnasium and a kitchen and offices, the kind of things that you'd see surrounding a typical Mormon chapel. I think on small residential projects, I'll just tell you what rules of thumbs are. They might range 10% or so, depending upon the work involved. And larger projects, 6 or 8. It's pretty hard to do anything and fall below about 6%. There's a lot of effort required there. And as with anything, you get what you pay for. There are congregations who will go out and say, we don't want to spend very much on design, and that's what they get. It's not a very thoughtful design. So I've just got something that we submitted when we that we wrote when we submitted this for a national award, and I wanted to read that to you before I ended. This is a little bit architectural, and it refers to some of my favorite architects. One of them in particular is Alvar Aalto, who's a great Finnish architect, and he did a lot of libraries and religious architecture in Finland, and he always incorporated natural light, especially in the Scandinavian countries where natural light is limited and they have the long winter nights. It's much more appreciated than it is living in our climate. Another great architect was Frank Lloyd Wright, and Frank Lloyd Wright's the success of his architecture was largely due to the way that he incorporated natural light into the spaces. The Prairie School of Architecture with the large cantilevered overhangs was a response to harsh, bright light and an attempt to reflect it once before it was brought into the space. So it became indirect light. It's soft and diffuse, and in buildings where natural light is incorporated and there's not glass that filters that light, flesh tones, true color rendition is possible, because natural light is the only full spectrum light that there is. There are no artificial lights, incandescent, fluorescent, of any kind that are really true representations of natural sunlight. Let me read this. It's not very long. God is light. Light is life. To see, to grow. A beautiful view of the Wasatch Mountains with undimmed light, the sincere dream of the congregation of St. Thomas More. How might this be done? How has it been done? Who has done this thing before? In this world of windows which filter and distort light, might a congregation enjoy a natural view, worship in natural light, and preserve the earth's precious natural resources? Reflected light, balanced light, full spectrum light, changing light, God's light, life's light. With this light we might see. With this light we might grow. Alvar Aalto, Louis Kahn, Frank Lloyd Wright, they know, they understand. Can we learn how to accomplish this wonderful dream? High-performance glass, precast concrete, controlled contrast ratios, computer simulation, prayer and humility, essential ingredients for understanding how to begin fulfilling this dream. Natural materials, local materials, sustainable materials, let our children's children's children share in our vision. Hear clearly the words, hear clearly the music, see clearly artistic interpretation of this time. An old understanding, a new understanding, a spring, summer, fall, and winter view delivered by the light of God to the congregation of the man for all seasons, St. Thomas More.
I was surprised that some of the terms that David used are the same terms that I will use. So, and I did not read any of his material beforehand. So, light in a Christian in Christian terms has always been a metaphor for truth. For the last 2,000 years, Christian architecture has been a struggle to develop structures that could be penetrated to allow in more light, natural light, God's light. The purpose was to create an atmosphere of otherworldliness, a holy place, a memorable place. When the early Christians emerged from the catacombs and their religion became legitimate, worship in daylight was indeed a celebration. And that celebration of light continued through the centuries. Here are a few examples. The Byzantine architecture, 4th and 5th century. Most people think that Hagia Sophia is a mosque in Ishtar, Muslim mosque, but it was originally built as a Christian cathedral. It was retrofitted as a mosque after the 6th century. But at any rate, here they built these incredible dome structures, and right at the top of the dome, they have arches allowing in the light, as well as rounded vaults penetrating into the dome. Next. You can see that better in this slide. See both the arches at the top, here. Next, Romanesque architecture, 9th and to the 12th century. Again, the penetration of the wall. And these are very simple, brutal, wonderful kinds of buildings. Let's see the next slide. And the rhythm of the windows and the columns really is the essence of the architecture. Gothic, next please. 12th to 15th century. Again, this was a period of real brinksmanship. These guys could not figure what they were doing. There was no engineering that could say, okay, this is safe and this isn't. So they messed around with flying buttresses, and sometimes they failed, and sometimes the roof fell in. But and even after it was completed and the congregation was using the buildings, there were cathedrals that collapsed. But they were going for the light, and you can see in this section that you see this whole area here from here to here to allow a stained glass window. These buildings often took 150 years to build. People who started them didn't see the completion. The grandchildren were the stonemasons that finished the buildings. Okay, next. Well, here's the backside of a cathedral. And again, the flying buttresses. That's an extra support, a marvelous idea to take the stress off the wall so that they could open it up for more light. Light was never celebrated more than in Gothic architecture, and that's when stained glass windows also developed. Next. This is Renaissance architecture, St. Peter's Cathedral in Rome. Here, they played with allowing the light to come in surreptitiously, like it was coming out of a break in the clouds. And you walk through, and you're not terribly conscious of the windows, except that you know that light is covering the walls. Filtered light. Okay, next. Okay, Baroque architecture. Here, the light was introduced as high as possible, again, to focus on the gilded, highly decorative sculpture and details. I don't have a slide of a New England church, but I think everyone's familiar with those. And I just got back from Martha's Vineyard, and I was astounded that 18th century churches in New England had enormous windows. Now, they weren't stained; they didn't use stained glass, just clear glass. But here they had another world outside that could be enjoyed from the interior. The change of seasons. You'd see the treetops were part of the building. And the change of light, the change of weather was very important. Early Mormon architecture took natural light seriously. One has to wonder whether the same people could produce a St. George or Logan tabernacle in one century and the standard plan in the next. Which then begs the question, what happened to these people? The characteristics of Christian architecture are church buildings were always the most important building, the best the community could provide. They were the community symbol, the most expensive, the most experimental structurally, and the most innovative in the use of natural light. And I think the Catholic Church would live up to that that definition or that description very well. However, the standard plan would have a difficult time measuring up. One, it is not the best building we could build. It is a building with very low expectations. It is a low, unimposing building, hardly a community symbol, and clearly does not look like a church. Three, it uses the cheapest and dullest structural systems and cheap materials on the majority of exterior surfaces. Four, most damning is the total lack of natural light in the sanctuary, the place for the holy gathering. Instead, one finds fluorescent lights and poor ventilation, a room that will never see sunlight. How could this have happened? As the church became more corporate in form, it also became more bureaucratic. Bureaucracy then took over the building of churches, which is really at the core of the problem. One, the central church assumed ownership of all buildings. The bureaucracy then was inspired to do buildings on the cheap. Two, roof leaks. This is the result of taking the cheapest bids and getting the poorest workmanship. But elimination of roof leaks is largely responsible for the development of the standard plans. No valleys, only ridges. Three, low side walls eliminated the cost of high exterior walls, characteristic of church architecture, but the end result looks more like a building sinking into the ground. Let's get to the next slide. These are, you know, depending on where you are, but they're over $1 million. Well, yeah, but you've got a cultural hall, and you've got a lot of classrooms in this building that you don't have in the Catholic Church. But the Catholic Church has a much, much bigger sanctuary. I mean, I'd say what? What, David? Three times bigger? The sanctuary? Seats 500. I think a typical Mormon chapel seats around 300, jammed in. And then they've got the doors to the cultural hall that, you know, for expansion, if they really get successful. Okay. People rebelled, and now we have roofs with many valleys and funny little fiberglass steeples. Even a few stingy windows have been added to the chapel, but the same low building is being built, which is no longer inexpensive. Unfortunately, children must endure these buildings, suffering through long meetings they don't begin to understand, but they know they are not in a pleasant place. Stuffy air and depressing light makes them want to flee. Worship then becomes a painful experience. Man living in nature, sharing a land with other animals and plants, will prosper in a natural habitat. And he will only continue to prosper as he recognizes and integrates those natural systems required for his survival. A hard, synthetic environment is antagonistic to his psychic well-being. Worshipping in synthetic light is an unnatural act. The standard plan is a gross violation of 2,000 years of Christian architectural tradition. Thank you. Okay, now let's have some questions. David, do you want to come forward? Sure. I worked in the church architect's office in 1956, and the standard joke in the office is that one day there will just be one plan, and everybody laughed like, you know, yeah, this is crazy, but it'll never get that bad. It has. You know, I don't know. One problem, the church builds temples in normally on sites in semi-residential areas where there are a lot of architectural controls. And I know probably one of the best temples built recently. It's the best. Is in San Diego, and it's really La Jolla, and they don't mess around with ugly buildings in La Jolla. Did you want to respond to that?
For worship, no matter what
you're saying. And I would think it. A Jewish and a Christian congregation. I mean, that's ecumenical to the point that's almost beyond. That a Jewish congregation and a Lutheran congregation build a chapel together, and they both use that chapel at different times. Maybe one on Saturday and one on Sunday, which works very well. And she said that natural light was a very strong component. Well, one of the most exciting experiences I had with religious architecture was an ecumenical building in Bountiful built by the Congregational Church and the Episcopalians. And there was an Episcopalian priest who was really a dynamic young guy, and again, we used artists from the area for the chalice and the crosses. There were three different crosses, a cross for the Easter, which was the celebration, the cross for the celebration, and then a black steel cross preceding Easter. Anyway, it was exciting. The women's auxiliary did the fractured glass windows. This is very thick. Glass. No, was your glass the fractured glass? Inch and a half thick, yeah. And they cast it in concrete. And, people were participated. And this was not a wealthy congregation at all.
Maybe you worked in the church architect's office. What about the use of local artists and art in Mormon architecture?
We had a stained glass window for the Capitol Hill ward. It was already designed. And it was already in place. And the stake president asked a general authority if it was all right. And I was on the high council, and I said, don't do that. I mean, just don't push it. It's like, David, you know, for good architecture, there's got to be a little larceny. You hide the facts a little bit, like you did, that you kept your budget for the art. A general authority was in our ward, and he said, we do not do stained glass windows. And that very month in the Ensign, they had an article on the great stained glass window tradition of the Mormon Church. And we haven't mentioned, with our Dean Watts here, I've got to say this, we haven't mentioned the music.
Same thing, if you can't control the art,
organ music in a Gothic cathedral is just incredible. And I don't know whether anybody can explain it. I don't know whether you can analyze it, but it is just it's just marvelous. David?
I talked a little bit about the lack of use of natural light in any buildings. I think the Mormon Church shouldn't blame them completely. A lot of the failure to do that is architecture, the profession of architecture, and what we have not learned how to do. When I went to architecture school, we learned how to do high-rise glass and steel buildings with tinted glass and fluorescent lights, and they could be built to any dimension because we have cheap electricity, and you can buy fluorescent lights, by the dozen. And we didn't need to worry about that anymore. No one was talking about it or teaching it. And there are a lot of architects out there that wouldn't have a clue as to how to properly introduce natural light into your space.
That's right. And I'd like to just mention air conditioning. That before air conditioning, well, Gothic architecture could not be built with air conditioning. Nor was it required. I mean, you had a Gothic cathedral was a community building, and you'd have those buildings packed with farmers with still a lot of the barn on their shoes. And that real high space, the bad air went up. And it could absorb a lot of body heat from these unbathed farmers, and it was still a very tolerable kind of space. I saw a church in Virginia in a new town, and it's a really classy place, and they had very strict architectural controls. And so the church could not build their standard plan, and they had to build a building. Most of the buildings were kind of Georgian, and so they had to build that kind of building. So that's when you can do it. External forces can make you do it, but a stake president can't pull it off. That's right. That's right. That's a real strategy, too, because there's a landmarks commission in Salt Lake City that you have to pass the landmarks before you can build a new building. So, anyway, that's a possibility. It's the cost factor. Two-thirds of the World Church is funded from the Wasatch Front. The funding capability of the church has not expanded as much as fast as the numbers. And so the idea is that we've got to build inexpensive buildings, jam three congregations in a building, which wins the cost or which saves the money to be a world church. That's basically the way it works. I'm not sure what year that the church took ownership of all buildings. You see, buildings preceding that were owned by the stakes. And somewhere in the 60s or 70s, Alan Blodgett just left. He could tell us. But I don't know exactly when that happened. But that's basically why the church controls the cost to the degree that they do. Let me just tell you another example of another congregation, a Lutheran congregation here in Salt Lake City, that had a budget of $150,000, and they were going to build a new church. This was 4 years ago. And I heard about it because my partner was on a planning commission out in West Jordan. And he said, we told him, that's impossible. You can't do it. And so I called their minister out of curiosity. And I said, you really can't do this. He said, oh, yeah, we're going to do it. And my wife's a landscape architect, and we're going to build from her plans. Well, I saw what she was proposing, and she was a very good landscape architect, but not a very good architect. And so I said, all right, I'll help you. And so our firm just took on the, we just donated the plans. But we got a church built for $150,000, and it's a big sanctuary. And it, you know, it's no masterpiece. It's certainly not the same thing you did, but we have a lot of windows. We used a lot of stained glass or a lot of sliding glass doors because they were the cheapest glass we could get for the building. And for $150,000, we got a chapel, three classrooms, the minister's office, two Johns, and a kitchen, and an asphalt parking lot. And one of the cost savings was the Lutherans have a group called Laborers for Christ. And these are guys my age. They got up on the roof when they're putting in the plywood, scare me to death. But anyway, these are guys my age, retired, and they come in and work for minimum wage, and they had their little campers, and they brought their wife along, and they just had a good time building this church. And anyway, that was another success story where the congregation, I think that the church is not only cheating the congregation of a marvelous experience, but also really not benefiting from some cost-saving participation. David?
I just wanted to make a comment about it. I visited a church in Ohio that was designed by Philip Johnson, and it's a church without walls. And someone commissioned him to design, and it's just an outdoor church, and it's mostly landscape architecture. And it only functions when the weather's good and when the weather's appropriate. But one of the things that I wanted to do at St. Thomas More that I couldn't talk them into is the space that's outside of the stained glass. There's a natural amphitheater that's built into the site there. And I wanted to add a couple of doors to the end of the building and thought that maybe for Easter service and a few special events that for no cost, basically, you could walk out those doors and worship in the out-of-doors, which I think would be a even more wonderful worship service than being in the building. So. There's a growing body of work, research in the effects of natural light on people. Seasonal affective disorders becoming understood more and more, and what they think causes that is that people don't, they're in an environment where they don't get enough intense natural light in the day to set their biological clock. And I think it's understood we have a circadian rhythm in our body that's about 25 hours long, and we live in a 24-hour day. And you have to set it with a certain intensity of natural light in each day in order to not be fatigued and other things happen to you. I'm not sure everything is understood about that, but it's a growing body of work.
I was pleased when Ron introduced me to a friend as I came in as a radical. And I would like to make a radical proposal. If any of you feel as I do, ashamed for the institutional church, I am not ashamed of the gospel. I don't believe most of it, but I'm not ashamed of it. But I am ashamed of the church. And I believe that the only answer to this shame for me, and perhaps for many of you, is to take back ownership of the church. We didn't know when they said, oh, we'll build your churches for you, but they all belong to us, what that meant. Even the smallest attempt on our part within a congregation to exercise freedom, our own control of our own lives in our own neighborhood will help all other congregations everywhere. That has to do with our choice of music. I agree 100%, Ron, with what you said. Don't ask. Have the kind of music that you love or that your congregation loves. Should be a congregational decision. And what courageous congregation will someday walk away from those buildings and say, we will not worship in that building, will be the way by which there is a way out of the morass. It will indeed take radical action on the part of a congregation someplace. It may only take one congregation in the entire Wasatch Front to turn it around so that the questions are asked again and the idea dawns that there are alternatives. There's no scriptural justification for any of this kind of control over the shape of the buildings that we worship in, or where the light comes, or what kind of music we will listen to. If the scriptures indeed were our foundation, it would be clear that we are free to use every possible means to express ourselves in worship to God. And so I urge you to consider the slightest forms of theological disobedience, to express, if you feel the same way that I do, shame and regret and being cheated out of one's birthright. That's what I feel today. This is the second session I've sat in like this. The music session earlier this morning and now this. I am not going to go kill myself, but I am going to become more radical.
A typical Mormon church will take in $450,000 to $500,000 a year, tax-free. Now, for them to spend $1 million on a chapel, it's paid off in 2 years. We could afford better chapels. Is our time up? I don't know. Okay, we thank everyone for coming, in particular Peter David for bringing his slides. And anyway, appreciate you being here.